Although the U.S. is a nation of immigrants, anti-immigration views have a long history in this country. Benjamin Franklin was hostile to Germans in colonial Pennsylvania. The Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 limited the ability of immigrants, especially radicals from France and Ireland, to gain full political rights. It became a major political issue in the 1800 election. So, should we be surprised by the current crisis involving a huge surge in the number of children trying to enter the United States, many of them alone? Ian Gordon has written several pieces on immigration for Mother Jones magazine, and his most recent in the July-August issue is titled, 70,000 Kids Will Show Up Alone at Our Border This Year, What Happens to Them? I'm very pleased it brings Ian Gordon to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
There have been a lot of reports on rapid growth in the numbers of unaccompanied children trying to sneak into the United States. How many children are there?
Well, right now, so far this year, this fiscal year, since October 1st, more than 57,000 kids have been apprehended by the Border Patrol. And the projection is somewhere between 70,000 kids and 90,000 kids will be caught by September.
So the numbers are growing exponentially?
Absolutely. Last year, a little less than 40,000 kids were apprehended. So we're seeing a huge jump, and that number has gone way up, basically since 2008. I mean, we were talking about, 20,000, 15,000 kids being apprehended. So that number has skyrocketed in the last several years.
And we're hearing about very young children. What's the age range of the children trying to enter the United States?
Well, the vast majority of kids are teenagers still, but a new report just came out today, actually, that shows that there's been basically a doubling of the number of kids under age 12. So there were more than 6,000 kids between the ages of 6 and 12 who've tried to cross the border this year, and 785 kids who are 5 years or younger, which is just incredible.
It's being called a crisis. What makes it a crisis? Is it the numbers, the age of those trying to enter, the huge increase in numbers?
I think all of those things, and I think also the situation that these kids are leaving in Central America. I mean, the vast majority of these kids are coming from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. Many of them are leaving, incredibly violent situations, particularly in Honduras, one of the most violent countries in the world, if not the most violent country in the world, and also in El Salvador, where there's been a really big gang struggle over the past decade or two. Also, Guatemala has, for forever now, pretty much, been an incredibly impoverished country, and kids are leaving there, or these particularly kids from rural areas in the western part of the country, are leaving really abject poverty.
So who is it a crisis for, the people trying to immigrate, or for the United States, or both?
I guess it depends on who you ask, and particularly which side of the political aisle you ask. Certainly, it is a crisis for children in Central America. And there's a crisis for families in Central America, in terms of what people are facing there on a daily basis and what people are leaving. There's a recent UN report basically said that almost 60% of the kids who are arriving in the United States have a international protection claim. What that means specifically is that almost 60% of these kids were threatened in some particular way, like their lives were threatened in their home countries. So I think that's something that is kind of getting lost. We think of this as, oh, they're just leaving a violent situation, or, oh, they're just leaving poverty. But these are kids who've been targeted. In terms of, is it a crisis at the border? Well, it's a crisis for the United States in that we have seemed to have been very unprepared for these kids, even though we've known that these numbers have been increasing for a long time.
Now, the reason that is relevant is they are depending on a Bush-era law?
Yes. So in 2008, Congress passed a anti-trafficking law that essentially separated Mexican and Canadian kids from kids from the rest of the world. So Mexican and Canadian kids, and really for all intents and purposes, we're only talking about Mexican kids, would be deported pretty quickly after a very short hearing at the border, whereas kids from the rest of the world, and in this case mostly kids from Central America, would be reunited, would go to shelters run by Health and Human Services and then be reunited with family pending a hearing, pending their deportation hearing. And so that wait, having those kids wait, you know, for going to a shelter and then going to their families for a while their hearings were going on, you know, suggested to some people in Central America, perhaps to these kids' families, that they could also go to the United States and get to stay with family. So there was an implication maybe that if you go to the United States and you get there and you're from Central America, you could stay for a while and maybe stay permanently.
That law guarantees children access to a federal asylum officer and a chance to tell a judge if they were being victimized in some way in their home countries. Does a requirement that unaccompanied minors appear before a judge make things fairer?
Well, it allows the kids to tell their story. You know, I think one of the things that I've written about is just the fact that many Mexican kids who've come across, you know, have a legitimate asylum claim, but there's no chance for them to actually talk about that in front of a judge. Instead, they're in this, they're in a border patrol station at the border, talking to a border patrol agent. And a lot of times, these kind of really brief talks that they have with these agents are, you know, really ineffective. They're an incredibly ineffective way to gauge a child's asylum claim. And so, you know, border patrol agents aren't. This is not their job. You know, their job is to protect the homeland. Their job is not specifically to, you know, to deem whether a child has a legitimate claim. And so what's happening is, you know, the vast majority of Mexican kids are being sent back, you know, without ever really being able to say one way or the other whether they have a legitimate claim. And that's, you know, changing this law that we mentioned earlier would essentially put Central American kids in the same boat and keep them from having the same opportunities to talk about what, you know, why they came and what dangers they face at home.
These kids are scared, and I suspect they're uncomfortable talking about their problems, but also, are they knowledgeable or literate enough to be able to find their way to their intended destinations?
You know, I mean, the range of kids is pretty incredible. I mean, you know, when I was doing some reporting in Central America last year, you'd hear stories of kids who were, you know, 11. I heard this incredible story of an 11 and 14-year-old. The siblings, the older sister was leading her brother through Mexico, and the younger brother was both blind and deaf. And the sister was leading him through Mexico. They were apprehended by the Mexican authorities and deported back to Guatemala. And, you know, the upon arriving back in Guatemala, they said, well, we're going to try again. I mean, we just don't have any other options. You know, other kids, you know, have no real sense of what they're going to face at the border. You know, they hear about the Rio Grande, and they say, you know, can I walk across it? Do I have to swim? Is there a boat? They just don't really know what's ahead of them, and they also don't know what they're going to face in terms of violence throughout Mexico, which, you know, can be an extremely dangerous journey.
On top of that, many of these kids don't even speak Spanish. They speak indigenous languages. So it makes it harder for people to know what they're talking about.
Particularly the kids from the Western Guatemalan Highlands. If you have kids who speak Quiche or Mam or a variety of the Mayan languages, you know, and of course a lot of kids from southern Mexico also. So, yeah, you know, those kids are isolated in a very different way.
My guest is Ian Gordon. His article, 70,000 Kids Will Show Up Alone at Our Border This Year, What Happens to Them, is in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is there a legal procedure for kids who are caught? Are they entitled to any kind of legal representation in the United States? The reason I ask is the Wall Street Journal reported last week that kids with legal representation are less likely to be deported.
That's true. You know, there's recent data from Syracuse University that kind of parsed that out. But no, kids are not these kids from Central America that we're talking about in this particular crisis have no recourse, have no legal representation. Now they can get legal representation from a variety of pro bono outfits out there, and there are some in South Texas. Like Pro Bar, which is run by the American Bar Association, and other groups like KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, that do a great job, you know, helping kids get pro bono legal support. But, you know, this is a very small percentage of kids. And, you know, one of the things that's it's interesting to think about when we talk about the kids who have lawyers, you know, having a higher likelihood of winning their cases, their asylum cases. You know, when a pro bono lawyer looks at, you know, is kind of talking to kids to determine whether or not to take their case, they decide, you know, based on how good a case it is. So a lot of times there's some self-selection going on there. You know, kids who have a good case are the ones that the pro bono attorneys want to represent. So it's a little hard to say to what extent that affects those percentages.
What dangers do the kids leaving El Salvador, Honduras, or Guatemala face at home? Is it more dangerous for them than it is for adults?
Well, you know, there are obviously unique dangers for kids, mostly around, particularly in when we're talking about Honduras and El Salvador, around the drug trade and around gangs. So there's a lot of gang initiations. There's sexual violence for girls. You know, there's a lot of initiation rites that kids have to deal with and are part of at a very young age. And are threatened with. I mean, really, that's what we're talking about. You know, depending on where you grow up in, say, San Pedro Sula or Tegucigalpa or San Salvador, you know, you may be exposed to certain people and certain gangs. And, you know, they know, you know, how old you are, and they know when it's time to start the process of trying to get you into that gang. And so what we're seeing is kids leaving to avoid that. Initiation, and you know, and to avoid getting into the gangs in the first place.
Didn't some of those gangs originate in the United States?
They did. You know, Mara Salvatrucha and the 18th Street Gang both, you know, have their origins in Southern California. And you know, it's been well documented the effect of deporting kids, you know, and young men from these gangs back to Central America. You know, has had in terms of spreading those gangs in the region.
These gangs are very aware of what goes on in the United States. They're rather sophisticated. Are they the ones who are organizing these trips for the kids to leave, or would they prefer for the kids to stay?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think, you know, more than anything, the kids seem to be fleeing, and you know the actual role that the gangs have is unclear. You know, I will say that when the kids get into Mexico, one of the things that we do know is that organized crime in Mexico basically runs the migration routes through the country, particularly on the infamous train known as La Bestia, the Beast, that runs from southern Mexico all the way basically to the U.S.-Mexico border. So the effect that organized crime in Mexico has, you know, whether that is Los Zetas or other criminal organizations, is very pronounced.
We've been talking about escaping the gangs and related matters. What about economics? For example, you write that the prices of tortillas have doubled in some of those countries. Why?
Well, it has there are a variety of reasons. You know, some of that has to do with U.S. corn production, and some of it has to do with domestic issues in Guatemala, for example.
Wait. U.S. corn production? Didn't corn originate in Mexico and Central America and Mesoamerica?
Yes, that's true. And Guatemalans are famously hombres de maíz, or men of corn. However, U.S. corn production, as I'm sure you know, you and your listeners will know, outpaces corn production elsewhere, and U.S. is a huge exporter of corn, including to Central America. So that obviously U.S. corn production has a huge effect elsewhere, and that's, you know, one of the things that we're seeing there. You know, and aside from, you know, corn production, there's you know, these countries are very affected by things like coffee blights and natural disasters. You know, there's an earthquake last year in Guatemala that had, you know, that definitely has an effect on whether people are going to leave and how people view their situation. So, you know, I think it's important to think about this wave of migration and this refugee crisis. You know, these things are all kind of mixed. There's violence, there's poverty. There's the regional susceptibility, and there's this history of migration. You know, I think it's really important to not, to not think of this as an isolated incident. You know, when we talk about Central America, this is a region that has been, you know, heavily linked to the United States for years. The United States has intervened militarily, economically, over and over again in the 20th century and before that. And we're still seeing kind of the kind of long reach of that into the 21st century.
My guest is Ian Gordon. His article, 70,000 Kids Will Show Up Alone at Our Border This Year, What Happens to Them, is in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. We'll take a little break and we'll come back with more. Stay with us. And we are back with Ian Gordon, whose article, 70,000 Kids Will Show Up Alone at Our Border This Year, What Happens to Them, is in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. You open your account with the story of a boy you called Adrian. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, I met Adrian at a school here in San Francisco called San Francisco International High School. He had been at the school for about a few months when I met him, and I was introduced to him by the principal of the school, Julie Kessler. Adrian was from Guatemala City. He was gay. He had come to the United States by himself, and he was fleeing gang violence. He grew up a street kid in Guatemala. His parents were both drug addicts, and he had kind of been with them for part of the time as a young child, but then separated from them as he got older. And he basically was extorted by the 18th Street Gang in Guatemala City. So he decided to come to the United States on his own. He felt like he needed to leave immediately. And he had a harrowing journey through Mexico. He rode La Bestia, the train that goes from southern Mexico to the border. He rode it all the way to the border. He rode back down to Guadalajara. He went then back to the border toward Arizona. He was a drug mule. Basically, he had no money, and so a local kind of drug dealer said, "Hey, if you want to cross the border, you're going to have to haul some marijuana for us." Eventually, he was picked up by the Border Patrol, and he went into this process that so many Central American child migrants are going through right now, where he was arrested by the Border Patrol. He was in Border Patrol custody for several days, and then he was put in a shelter that was run by Health and Human Services. And then, because he had no family in the United States, he had really no family anywhere, he was sent to San Francisco and put in a local shelter here in San Francisco, where he stayed for the last year and a half.
Now, not all of these kids can become drug mules. Some of them are a little young. Do their families pay for the kids to be smuggled across the border? How much does this cost?
Yeah, I think, you know, the vast majority of these kids, when we talk about unaccompanied kids, it's not as if, you know, they're getting up and walking from San Pedro Sula all the way to the United States. I mean, you know, they're coming as part of a pretty large organization of smugglers who work, you know, in concert with various criminal organizations. So, you know, these kids will often contract a local coyote or pollero, as they're known in Central America, who will, you know, get that person to Mexico and maybe get them all the way through Mexico or, you know, hand the kids off. But then those kids are brought basically to the border. And, you know, I've seen many times before, you know, many stories of these smugglers. They're not very trustworthy people. So, you know, kids are often left at all the different points in Mexico, whether it be in southern Mexico or near Mexico City or all the way at the border. They can be left at any point. They can be abused by their smugglers, who have, you know, all the power in the world over these kids. And, you know, the families have paid $3,000, $5,000, $8,000 to have their kids sent. You know, the more money these parents spend, maybe the safer the journey. And I say maybe because, you know, it really depends on the family's connections and how savvy they are about the process.
Governor Perry of Texas has just declared that he was going to send out the National Guard to the borders. Could some of these kids be killed?
Well, I think, you know, sending the National Guard seems to be about optics and how that looks, you know, to kind of give the impression that that Texas is doing something about this. You know, the fact of the matter is many of these kids are coming. The vast majority of these kids, at least from the news reports that I've read, upon crossing the border are actively seeking out Border Patrol agents, and they're turning themselves in, partly because of this misunderstanding about, you know, their hopes of getting some sort of asylum upon turning themselves over to the U.S. government. So, you know, I think putting more troops on the border is a bit misguided in terms of helping this particular crisis.
Is this a problem for the federal government or for the states? What's the Obama administration doing to address the crisis other than requesting $3.7 billion in emergency appropriations that Congress is obviously not going to give him?
Well, it's a problem for both sides. I mean, right, it's a problem for the federal government because the federal government is in charge of protecting the borders. I mean, that is explicitly, the responsibility of the federal government. Now, of course, it's a problem for the states because, you know, states like Texas and Arizona and California have borne the brunt of this over the years in terms of having a large undocumented population and all of the accompanying costs that go along with that. Now, I think the Obama administration has sent some mixed messages, to be honest. I mean, they've called it an urgent humanitarian crisis at the border, but then they've talked about changing this law. I mean, if it's such a humanitarian crisis, why would you want to change the law that allows kids to have hearings, and why would you try to send kids back to what is a potentially dangerous situation without finding out what their particular situations are? I mean, I think the Obama administration is really at a crossroads here, and this huge appropriations request, was a bit surprising. I mean, a lot of people thought they were going to ask for around $2 billion. Instead, they asked for almost $4 billion. It's going to a variety of things. It's going to more immigration judges, which would help speed the process. That's something that a comprehensive immigration bill would have helped as well.
Does the same process apply when kids come in from Asia, for example, or Europe?
Yes. I mean, if you were unaccompanied, and you were to come from China, for example, you would go through the same process. It's not just Central American kids. We're talking about this, though, because, the vast majority of these kids have come from Central America. But absolutely, there have been unaccompanied kids from all over the world, over 150 countries, I believe, at the last time I checked. So, people are coming from all over. Kids come from all parts of the world, from Sri Lanka, from sub-Saharan Africa, from Europe, unaccompanied. Kids are coming from everywhere. And, there's some historical basis for this, too. I mean, my colleague Tasneem Raja wrote a really wonderful piece recently about how the first person at Ellis Island, the first person in line at Ellis Island the day it opened, was an unaccompanied child migrant from Ireland who was here, whose parents had come several years before, and she was traveling from Ireland with her two younger siblings. And she was the first person, and she was welcomed with a $10 gold coin and a certificate. It's not exactly the way that we're treating our unaccompanied child migrants today.
Wendy Young, Executive Director of Kids in Need of Defense, says this is becoming less like an immigration issue and more like a refugee issue. And the writer Sonia Nazario has pointed out that we expect countries next to ravaged places like Syria or Iraq to absorb millions, not thousands, of immigrant refugees. And although the parallel isn't exact, we're comparing gang violence with full-out war, still she says the demands that being placed on the United States aren't the same either, that you could spread the responsibility among the 50 states and that would be purely manageable. And then we see what happens when the president asks somebody like the liberal governor of Connecticut, Danielle Molloy, to temporarily house 2,000 immigrant children at a vacant training school in the town of Southbury, Connecticut. Governor Molloy said, no, we don't currently have the ability to meet this request. And a number of other governors from blue states have also refused to place the kids. So this is not just a Democrat-Republican thing.
No, I mean, I think there is a certain amount of NIMBYism on both sides of this, both sides of the political divide. You know, at the same time, you're also seeing some really, really wonderful and open-armed, you know, calls for these kids to come to places. I mean, you know, recently we saw a judge in Dallas County, Texas, you know, say that, yes, we will house 2,000 kids, and that was pretty unexpected. And also, the governor of Massachusetts just the other day gave a very heartwarming speech. You know, Deval Patrick got in front of the state and said, "Hey, you know, this is a responsibility that we have as a state to help these kids." So I think,
but he offered to take 1,000 kids. We're talking about 57,000 kids right now.
It's true. I mean, there are many more kids. You know, you're not going to see a state say we're going to take, you know, 15,000 kids. You know, and one of the things is, you know, the federal government had a system basically that was set up to house 6,000 to 8,000 to 9,000 kids, you know, at any given time. So, you know, when you have 57,000 kids come in over the course of 4, 5, 6 months, that system is obviously going to be overtaxed and, you know, totally insufficient for this kind of influx. And so, you know, the question is, where do we go next? I mean, we're talking about the projections for next year are upwards of 150,000 kids. I mean, that's where we're at now. So you know, we need more than a short-term fix for this. I mean, there needs to be a much longer-term thinking about how we're going to dissuade kids from coming to the United States. And for those kids who do come, we have to be realistic and figure out a way to actually house them and keep them safe.
Because the conditions in a typical shelter are not all that nice, although it has led to a certain amount of bombast in Congress. One congressman said that the kids are being put up in a 5-star hotel, and then it was pointed out that a check with TripAdvisor described it as the worst hotel anybody has ever been to. But what are the conditions of a typical shelter? Were you allowed access to any of them?
No. So there's two kinds of shelters, and I think that's important when we talk about this, because what we've been seeing on the television, for example, over the past several months are Border Patrol emergency shelters. So either they're Border Patrol stations or they're shelters set up in places like Nogales, Arizona, or, you know, military bases like Lackland Air Force Base in Texas that are emergency, that are basically set up as overflow shelters. And those aren't meant to hold kids for a very long period of time at all. And, you know, in the kind of legal parlance, they're not child-specific or child-sensitive shelters. I think the shelters that we usually talk about when talking about unaccompanied minors are the ones run by Health and Human Services, which is where these kids go after they've been detained. So they go there for a while, you know, the people can talk to them about their cases, or they can get, you know, your kind of legal orientations, and then they can get reunified with family pending their removal hearings. And those shelters have been totally closed off to the media. HHS has been incredibly opaque. I mean, it was very difficult in my reporting to get them to comment at all. And this was before
FOIA request.
So I had to FOIA just to find out where these shelters were, and they wouldn't give me street addresses because of the concern for smuggling, you know, and you know, not wanting any human traffickers to know where these kids were. So they would tell me the town, and I was able to find out, you know, that in the past, so that last year, in last fiscal year, there were 80 shelters, and that was up, from 33 in 2005. So there's been a shelter building boom, and now there's well over 100 shelters, including all the emergency shelters. But these shelters, we don't really know a lot about them. I mean, from what I've heard from advocates is that they treat the kids really well, that there's some schooling in there, that the kids can play, you know, they're child appropriate. But, you know, the kids are in these shelters for a very short amount of time. I mean, it used to be that they were in there.
We've unfortunately run out of time. But thank you so much. It's a big story. 70,000 kids will show up alone at our border this year. What happens to them is in the current issue of Mother Jones. My great thanks to Ian Gordon, who wrote the article.